This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 152.
Hello, and welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where it's all about empowering you to run a marathon and change your life. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we interview Dr. Jeff Brown, a Harvard psychologist and author of the book, The Runner's Brain. And in the quick tip segment, Angie will answer a question about how long should your longest training run be before a marathon. And if you want to run a faster marathon or half marathon, find out how to train with us and our awesome online community when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. Well, Angie, since we recorded our last episode, you've actually signed up for another race, right? Or another couple races. So I don't know if we've talked about this new adventure you're going on, but you're still training for that big 50 miler in October and decided to incorporate another ultra marathon as part of your training for the 50 miler.
Yeah, that's right. I was looking for a marathon actually to do during my peak training week for the 50 miler. Because, I mean, who wants to run over 20 miles on their own just because?
If you can get a medal for it at the end and a t-shirt and have people to chat with.
Yeah, like supported aid station kind of thing. And then I thought a trail marathon would be better because I'm actually going to be running a trail 50 miler.
Right.
So, and I didn't really want to travel too far. So I found actually three races. I guess it's like kind of like a race weekend up in Illinois, the middle of September. And so it starts with a 10K night race on Friday night, and then there's a 25K trail race on Saturday morning, and a 50K trail race on Sunday morning. And then if you do the trifecta, you know, you get all this special stuff. So, of course, I had to sign up for all three.
All right, so that's called the Rock Cut Hobo Runs in Rock Cut State Park outside of Rockford, Illinois.
So if you're going to be in the area, check those races out. Maybe do one or all, and maybe I'll see you there.
That's right. And I got the Tupelo Marathon coming up next weekend at the time of this recording. So a lot of this, you know, runner's brain, mindset, psychology stuff, I'm really, really going to be clinging to it as we go into Tupelo because part of me is kind of thinking, oh, man, what's coming here? You know, what am I getting myself into? Well, we got a great interview today. We've got this Dr. Jeff Brown. We've been looking forward to having him on the show for a while now. We're going to get into a lot of stuff that's going to help you on your long runs and your training, just from a psychological standpoint. Before we do that, to keep the enthusiasm going out there, we want to just make a couple shout-outs here real quick.
This note comes from Missy on our private Facebook page. She says, I just finished 13 miles. This is my longest run in 2.5 years. My pace was kind of all over the place, but I felt good. I'm so glad I found MTA and became a member. This is such an inspiring group. Have a great day, everyone.
It really does feel good when you get to like a milestone like that. We call them milestones. When you get to a distance that you haven't got to before or that you haven't got to in a long time, and just to see that you're making progress.
That's right. It really, really makes it worth it.
Yeah. So thanks for the message, Missy, and keep up the good work.
That's right. This next one is a note from Molly over on our Facebook page as well. And I thought this was appropriate because we had the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and the devastation that it did down in the Gulf Coast. And she had some firsthand experience with this. I thought I'd read her note real quick. She says, I just wanted to share, it's the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We literally lost everything but the clothes on our backs. The only other thing I took with me when we evacuated was my running shoes. It's kind of funny when I think about it now. Our entire town and the Mississippi Gulf Coast was destroyed. The emotions have been high for the last couple of weeks. I remember I was training for my first marathon when the storm hit. I was actually at my peak fitness. After the storm, there was nowhere to run. I had no idea how much damage wind and water could do to roads. It looked more like an earthquake than a hurricane. It took about 7 months before it was safe to really run again. Still, I would find myself falling in holes or on debris. I even tore the ligaments in one foot. Running has always kept me sane. I needed it more than ever. I remember feeling so lost, not being able to do what had always made me so happy. Now when I run, I often think about that time. I'm so grateful that my town has rebuilt, and I still get to look out to the beach every day.
Wow, that's great. Thank you, Molly, for sharing that remembrance and giving us a perspective of someone who was there and someone who was a runner at that time, because that's a perspective I haven't heard yet.
Exactly.
We're looking forward to meeting Molly in Tupelo. She's doing, I think, the half marathon there, right?
That's right.
So thanks for that message, Molly, and here's to your success at Tupelo.
And this last email says, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. First, I wanted to extend a heartfelt thank you for your podcast and the impact they've had on me. After being an athlete for most of my life and even playing college soccer, I found myself injury-ridden and a little defeated in the past few years. I ended up having a second knee surgery and dealing with a few, probably soccer-related, chronic injuries that kept me out of my running shoes for an extended time. And as you well know, the idea of getting back in shape was daunting until I found MTA. After surgery last March, I began running and completed a half marathon, but the training plan caused a lot of stress on my knee and I ended up with some minor injuries that started acting up. Then I found your half marathon plan, and I finally felt I had found a way to fit running into my life without sacrificing my health. I'm now using your beginner marathon training plan to get ready for Chicago, my first marathon, and I felt great running 16 miles last week." And she says, "If you're ever back in Boston, we should definitely do a meetup." And that comes from Lindsay.
Well, thank you for writing in, Lindsay, and I'm glad the training is going well for Chicago. And yeah, we'd love to meet up with you someday in Boston or wherever. And she also wants us to mention a 5K that she's co-directing in Boston. It's called the Joggin' for Frogmen Race Series, and it goes to benefit some great foundations there connected with the military, I think. If you're in the Boston area, or if you like to do these things virtually, you can find out about Joggin' for Frogmen over on our website, or go to jogginforfrogmen.com. We've got a great episode today. We're going to talk with a psychologist, and a couple of things before we get into it. I just want to give you a heads up. You'll probably enjoy this conversation more. Dr. Brown has worked in the medical tent at the Boston Marathon for years, and he's there as a psychologist, and he'll talk about like what service he can provide to runners as a psychologist. A lot of it has to do with pain management. We also get into this technique of dealing with pain in a marathon, and it's a technique called disassociation, and it's really powerful. And when he talks about it, he's going to have you pinch yourself and keep pinching yourself while he's talking. So that's a key thing to remember. Okay, so whenever he asks everybody to pinch themselves, you'll get more out of it if you actually do it and just keep pinching. Yes, I don't know if we've ever asked people to do that before on our podcast.
Pinch yourself to make sure you're awake.
Yeah. So I hope you enjoy it. We'll catch you on the end of this interview. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. All right, we're on the podcast today with Dr. Jeff Brown. He is the lead psychologist for the Boston Marathon and a member of the Runner's World Scientific Advisory Board. He's assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and McLean Hospital, and he's author of the forthcoming book, The Runner's Brain, How to Think Smarter and Run Better, which is due out in the first part of October. So, Dr. Jeff Brown, welcome to the MTA podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this all day. Actually, for weeks, we've been trying to pull this together. So this is wonderful.
The stars have finally aligned and we're connected.
That's right. That's right.
I think we've been looking forward to this for years because we have a mutual friend and they gave us a copy of one of your other books, The Winner's Brain.
Yes.
And told us all about you. And we're like, we got to get this guy on the podcast. And we got in contact with you and you said, let's hold off until my other book comes out, The Runner's Brain, and we'll do that. So here we are.
Here we are. The Runner's Brain is headed your way.
That's right.
It's a great book, by the way, folks need to get it. You can pre-order through a link on our site, but we'll talk more about that later. Let's get into some questions about you. What led you to study psychology and eventually become lead psychologist at the Boston Marathon?
Well, that's a long story, and you probably don't want to hear everything about that. My mother would tell you that whole story if you wanted to hear it. But, you know how that is. But I tell you what, I started out in undergrad in Missouri at Southwest Baptist University, and I just started majoring in psychology. I loved it in high school and then realized that, hey, if I'm going to do this, I need to go on to graduate school. So I did that, went to University of Central Missouri, then went on to the Forest Institute. Then did an internship in Louisiana where I started working more seriously in the sports psychology area, working with a minor league baseball team there, and then out to Harvard for a second fellowship that I did in child and adolescent psychology. And during that time, got connected with a good colleague, friend of mine, Art Siegel, who has been on the medical team for a long time, years and years. And the thing that Art said is that, you know, we could really use a psychologist in the medical tent because of hyponatremia, because you're going to recognize symptoms before we get lab work back oftentimes. And so I felt the pressure of that, of course, but it was true that I could start identifying people that had psychological or psychiatric symptoms, because you know what it's like. It doesn't matter if you're running a 5K. It doesn't matter if you're running a ultra marathon. At some point, you kind of hit a point where you may not be doing as well as you thought you would be. And I always like working with runners. Runners, by admission, are obsessive people. They love information. And that's why I knew several years ago that I wanted to put together the runner's brain after having worked with the Boston Marathon for, goodness, close to 15 years now, I believe.
Okay, let's just back up to the hyponatremia. But can you just briefly describe, like, what is that and how did your role help identify that?
Sure. Well, hyponatremia, if folks don't know, is when simply your system has more water in it and it kind of dilutes the salt levels that you have. So then you can start having symptoms of disorientation. I've noticed a lot of runners who become obsessive about a physical body part. That's just been my experience, but I'm very interested in that piece of why people that claim something as far as a symptom goes, but then it can't really, we have obvious, like somebody who thinks that they can't see, but they can tell you how many fingers they're holding up. And they'll say, I know it's crazy, I can't see. But so they're, you know, those are unusual sorts of situations. Not everybody that comes in is going to be having hyponatremia, but there are certain days that we're more aware of that, like when it's going to be a warmer run, because people, particularly the research has shown that novice runners, usually women who have times over 4 hours, are kind of the target, are more apt to get hyponatremia. Why? Well, one thing is that they probably drink all the time, because common sense as humans, we think, oh, it's going to be hot. I've got to be fueled up. I've got to not dehydrate. I need that on board. But all the time that's actually happening, you're drinking and you're diluting. And a couple of things that you'll notice, too, that throughout the course, at least of a marathon, I think with the 5K, you don't have to worry about hyponatremia. But with the longer runs, definitely you need to, if you're a kind of a novice runner, you're female. I've seen men, though, who have had hyponatremia coming in, yelling at the top of their lungs, I have hyponatremia. And it's, you know, that's the evidence of the obsessive runner that wants to have information and wants to learn. Well, this guy diagnosed himself and he was right. But a couple of other things, you actually gain weight over the course with hyponatremia. So if you haven't gone to the bathroom and you're not really sweating, that means that fluid's not getting out of your body. So that means that the salt level is diluting. So that's what we look for. And you can pick that up in blood work. We do in Boston, blood work is done right there in the tent. If you're a fan, or if you've seen on TV Land or whatever, the old good old TV show MASH, that's what our tent is set up like, and has about 200 cots in there. And it gets full in the afternoon.
Wow. I had the privilege of running the Boston Marathon this year. Unfortunately, didn't have to visit the medical tent, but give us an example of some of the work you do there. You know, obviously you've talked about looking for signs of hyponatremia. Talk about other things that you have to help people through.
Sure. Good question. Well, I initially went in to help with the hyponatremia, and that first race in 2002, it was obvious that there were so many things going on that were psychological. So I may help runners with like pain management, for example. They're cramping and they never have. They've got something that's pulling. They end up in this medical tent. They don't have family here. What's this all about? Kind of helping process that. The last couple of years, I've actually been at the finish line since 2013. My role has shifted that I have a team of mental health people. I've had a colleague for many years that worked with me in the medical tent. But then after 2013 occurred, I had a team of 60 mental health people. And then last year, we reduced that down to around 45. We could see how we could be more efficient with fewer people, but all really well-trained folks that really understand how the culture of running has changed and how to respond there. So there's always runners that have all kinds of emotion. You know, it's a very personal thing, as you both well know. Some people are dreading going back and telling their friends. Some are dreading walking out of the tent and seeing their spouse who's been complaining for years that, you know, your running is taking time away from family and we don't get to do this, we don't get to do that. It's always your training schedule. And, you know, helping people formulate that and be there with them if they need that kind of support, in because then they feel really defeated. Right. But it can just be a little bit scary. I also do a lot of speaking before, like at the Runner's Expo, where I talk about some of the things that I discuss in the runner's brain. That's another fun thing, is because people want to come up and they want to talk about the psychological stuff. But they, you know, I think one thing about the runner's brain, and I was speaking, emailing back with Bill Rogers, and he said, you know, the body, the shoes, everything's been on, been in the spotlight, and it's time for the brain to be in the spotlight. And, you know, cause it's always the runners will come up after I've spoken, but they kind of catch me over the side cause they don't want to be seen talking to, you know, the head guy. So, but you know, really that is changing. People, I know that you've asked your community about questions, and boom, 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 questions pop up. And we've done some specific training for Boston Marathon runners prior to the run. We've also done specific training for our volunteers since 2013 related to just psychological aspects of the different things that can go on with runners at this point. So the culture's changed. The people haven't changed. And I think, again, kudos to runners who are adaptable. They don't back down. They keep going. And I think that's a wonderful thing that again, I love doing what I'm doing as a sports psychologist working with runners. It's just, it's so much fun.
And you know, if you run the Boston Marathon, you're in great hands with that great team in place there.
You know, that team has been in place, goodness, 35 years probably. And they're always traveling and making sure going to other places, other marathons. We have lots of guests that come in to see how it's run there. A good friend of mine, Chris Tranis, is in charge of organizing. I don't know how he keeps it all in his brain. The amazing things that he gets done. And just a wonderful guy, great leader, and I've worked really closely with him on the mental health piece. It's been a positive thing, you know, because who are we kidding? Running is mental as much as it is anything.
You're right. And I think that's one huge thing I like about the book, is that, you know, we've read books before that talk about you need to work on the mental side of running, or you need to visualize your success, all that kind of stuff. But I love that your book is so practical, and you not only talk about that and all the psychological processes behind it, but you also talk about how to do that and specific exercises, and you really break it down. So let's kind of dive in. You know, as runners, we all know that running is really good for our body, but talk about what specific ways it's good for our brains.
Yeah. So I'll tell you a couple of things really quickly. One, we just know that exercise and movement is really helpful for our brain. It helps the brain to grow. It helps with just so many things as far as, regardless of how old you are, just movement will help your brain. Neuroplasticity is something that people are hearing more and more about, and that's the brain's ability to change. Our brains, even in this conversation, have been changing multiple times, because as I've described things, you visualize things, that's your brain doing that. And then as I listen to your question, that's going into my brain in a different part, you conjured that question up in a different part of your brain. So while we like to think we know so much about our brains, there's so much more to know. And I don't know that we'll ever know actually all about our brains, because it's just such a complex thing. We go to sleep, but why? Well, it's because our brain has us go to sleep. It has to cool down so we can go to sleep. But yeah, so the brain is so malleable and flexible and can be trained. That's why the whole idea of the runner's brain has cognitive behavioral psychology science behind it. And a lot of them are fMRI studies, which actually look at the brain as it's functioning, healthy brains. So we can see that there are certain activities that do actually cause the brain to light up in different ways. Just knowing that there's a certain thing that I can intentionally do to cause my brain to do a particular action or to build on something is a wonderful thing.
Well, Angie, and what he said about neuroplasticity and how, you know, our brains can change and how running helps, I just wanted to say that It's proof that there is hope for me.
Keep running and you'll eventually get there. Yeah.
We actually had two copies sent to you, one for each side of your brain, Trevor.
That's right.
Because we do believe there's hope for you.
Yeah. So I really like the chapter, "I think, therefore I am a runner." Nice Cartesian inference there. "I think, therefore I am." And can you take a moment and explain the RAS, reticular activating system? Just makes me sound smart saying it. Love it.
It does. Yeah. You even look smarter saying it. You know, so the reticular activating system is this little spot in our brain. We'll never see it, hopefully. We'll never lay eyes on it. But it's that same part of your brain that if you hear something in the night, it picks up on it. If somebody sneaks up behind you and says boo, you know, that's the part that catches your attention. It's the attention getter is what it is. It's shown that in research that the RAS, the reticular activating system, can only take in so much information. So kind of think of what it might be like overload for like a fireworks display around the 4th of July. The first one goes off and it's just particularly noticeably loud. But now they start going off more and more. And what do we start doing? Well, we start kind of habituating to it. They're not all loud. Now we're paying attention to the colors and designs and, you know, that one exploded. What shape was that? You know, and so our attention starts going other places. But that's a good example of how you can have so much stimulation going on in an environment that, one, concentration is important, but controlling the messages that you send to your RAS is very important, particularly when you're trying to learn to run, get into a routine, get back into a routine, getting over an injury, preparing for a big race, because you want to be sending messages to that part of your brain since it can only hold so much. Think of a thimble. And that you have BBs, and that thimble will only hold so many BBs. It won't hold that many, so you have to be selective with what you put in there. So that means that you have to be not just kind of the old Saturday Night Live Stuart Smalley, you know, I'm smart enough and good enough and like me, but evidence-based things that really send the message that you are a runner and you are competent and you are able. I think people get nervous around certain things. But again, if you look at the cognitive model, why is it you're nervous? Well, I'm afraid that I'm not going to do well. What evidence do you have that you're not going to do well? Well, you know, I talked to one person down in Houston because they do a half and a whole at the same time, one or two laps to make the half or whole. And a bunch of people at work decided they would run the half marathon, including a woman who had not trained for the half marathon. And she was camped out in a cot, you know, after about, I don't know, mile and a half she'd walked. And what was going through her mind? Well, the evidence was, well, you hadn't trained, so you don't really need to be disappointed because you weren't prepared for this. And that's not criticism. That's just helping you think differently. So if you really do want to run a half marathon, you have to change how you think about the whole thing. But I think people and runners need to rely on their thinking and their beliefs about what it is they know they've done in preparation for things. Now you have bandits that get out there and run and, you know, probably their blood alcohol content is high. We get to also take care of bandits that come in the medical tent too, because they're not in good shape often. And they end up in there as well because they need some sort of care. But again, they've not prepared. They're like, and for those, I think that's a term everyone knows. Sure. A bandit. Yeah. Somebody just jumps in and runs, you know, and they just run because they think they're going to just run. And sometimes they've been at a party and drinking and so forth. So
that's interesting. We've talked about bandits, and we had a whole episode where we talked about race cheaters, but I never thought that these people had probably not trained. They're just jumping in the race and they didn't do all the work of training for this thing.
Yeah. So that's my next book, The Bandit's Brain. Starting with the frontal lobe that is sloshing in alcohol. You know, it's just kind of the frontal lobe just like back and forth, just floating there.
It'll be a short book for this small attention span.
lots of pictures. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, looking at the reticular activating system, sending the messages that you are a runner, telling people about running, don't overwhelm them with that, but, you know, do things that you would expect a runner to be doing. That means invest in some good shoes and have something on your desk at work that refers to running, or put something underneath your signature line on your emails, a favorite running quote. Go ahead and build that list of songs that you like when you run. Put up running posters at home, someplace where it's appropriate. Things that you can be doing that you can identify as a runner. What do runners do? They get information. Have a stack of books by your bed that you read, because that's what runners do. So all these BBs that we're sending into the thimble, if you will. I've never used that example. It just came up.
It works. Yeah.
It works. So when you're doing that, you are sending the messages rather than sending BBs that say, you know, I'm not really that great of a runner, or no one's going to see me as a runner, or I never ran in high school. All these negative things that can happen. Or you get out your running shoes that you haven't worn in, you know, 3 months, and they look tired and worn out. And, you know, get some shoes that are brightly colored, so people will say, hey, did you get a new shoe? Yeah, I run. And see, it's that easy, because people will say those things, and they'll be reinforcing that too. Friends and family, build a little bit of a support group around you. They don't know that they're helping you build that RAS and get that information in there. But just like that first big explosion from a firework, it captures your attention and goes into your brain. That is what we want to send into the brain. We don't want to give it any room. We want to protect that part of our brain by sending specific messages that are positive.
Awesome. So if we send information to our brains that we're runners, and there's indicators of that in our environment, like hanging up our past medals, you know, for marathons or something like that.
Yeah.
Then isn't it natural for humans to want to live in congruity with how they view themselves? So if you see yourself as a runner and you got a long run coming up this weekend, you're more likely to get out and do it instead of procrastinate it, because in the core of your beliefs about yourself, you have told yourself over and over that you're a runner.
That's right. That's what you do. And I like how you said that. It becomes congruent with the environment, and the things around you are reflective of who you are. There are so many things that we have as, and this is getting at the identity piece, that so many people struggle with because of what they set their goals to be. Or, you know, you've got the bucket list runners, you have the lifetime runners that just one run is one in just a jillion runs. Those sorts of factors really bring about, you know, identity. Do I just want to be able to check the box? I'm a check the box runner. I did it. Yeah, I did that back in, you know, 89. That's what it was like. But is that really an identity? Probably. Well, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not an identity. But we have identities as humans in so many other domains as well. If you start thinking about that, all you're doing is trying to beef up that identity as a runner. And that's how you do that. Because, for example, people who don't have kids and then they have a child, guess what? Where does their attention go? Right to everything about that child. And what happens? They can't even remember what they did before having a child. And now it's a matter of the identity has shifted. So we just have the advantage of being able to do this sort of thing and do it deliberately and intentionally.
Good
stuff. In the book, you talk about goal setting and a lot of visualization, which I really liked. Why is this so good for our brain and our running in particular?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people, how many times have we heard the old phrase about, I practice like I'm going to play? Well, that usually means I'm going to try to practice perfectly. But our brains are wired differently than that. One, our brains are really good at using visualization, using all five senses. The thing about the visualization is that your brain really can't tell a whole lot of difference between the visualization, if you do it well, and you actually doing it. Now, certainly you can't just visualize as a bandit and then go out and run, right? But you can visualize and rehearse, because again, your brain loves novel circumstances, unique circumstances. I hear it all the time from people who come from a different climate and, I don't know that I can run here. Or they'll say in Boston, they may say, what is a nor'easter? You know, because I've never run in a nor'easter. But trying to simulate those things is very, very important. And we know from research that individuals who do that and visualize that, not just in running, but it just sports across the board, their performance tends to really be very similar to the person who actually physically practices it. So
that's amazing. Just visualize it in your mind. It's like doing the physical training.
You can get gains just by visualizing it.
Yes,
what I'm doing this weekend. You know, forget that long run.
You need that long run. Yeah. Well, I think it's one thing that's become more and more popular over the years is that you have individuals that you can see them at the expo where they're watching the course, where they have the course sped up and you go through the whole 26 plus miles. Mm-hmm. And you do that like in what, 5 or 10 minutes, and you see everything. And I like that concept, but we know from research that if you're going to do that, you're going to visualize, you need to use all the senses, including smell and touch. You also want to do it in real time. So you don't want to, you know, have this Chariots of Fire moment where you're, you know, chug, 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 crossing the finish line or something like that. You want to visualize in real time what you're going to do. And I encourage runners to visualize the things that are potential pitfalls, because that's the thing that's going to matter the most. And somebody, well, you want us to practice doing something wrong? Well, no, you're actually visualizing something happening that's out of the ordinary, and you're actually practicing the positive of knowing how you're going to rebound from that. That's part of what we call the proactive brain. That's the proactive brain likes circumstances that are new, novel, unique, because when you get back in that situation again, then you're more apt to be able to solve that. It makes good sense, but it also applies. I have a kind of special place in my heart for how children and kids and athletes are doing things. And sometimes we you know, I see parents sometimes who, you know, they've got the, let's pick a sport, soccer. Soccer's popular. And so they've got extra lessons with the soccer coach, and they've got this soccer ball that they had. It was purchased in England and shipped over here because it's just like their favorite team over there. And they've got, you know, 18 million jerseys, all of which don't fit. They'll grow into eventually. And so they're doing all of those things. But it's also helpful to that child's brain to do something like pick up a musical instrument and just mess with it. You don't have to even make it sound good. Just giving your brain something new to do. Like, okay, what are you going to do if you hit the wall? You know? Is it required of this race that you hit the wall? Well, so many people are already telling their RASs that I'm the kind of runner who hits a wall. Hmm. But you know what? There are lots of runners who never hit the wall. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting if you start thinking about, oh, well, how do I think about this? The runner's brain has a lot of worksheets in the back to help people with not just like trying to remember everything we're talking about, but actually put pen to paper the old fashioned way and doing it that way. I think it's the best way to do that.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, talking about hitting the wall, which, you know, some people, I think maybe it's just a fear of theirs. They've heard a lot about it. They've read about it. Maybe it's never happened to them before, but they think inevitably it's coming for me, you know, that kind of that right. mentality. And so they kind of set themselves up maybe for that experience. But instead you're saying, you know, think about if this happens to me, it's not a guarantee. If this happens, how am I going to deal with it and get past it and still have a successful race? And visualizing success, even if it does come, you'll know what to do in that situation.
Yes, exactly. And it's also a common thing. You talk about goal setting. It's a common, becoming more common way of thinking about having goals that are multiple. So you'd have like three different goals for a race rather than just one goal. Talked to a guy one time who was from Sweden, and he missed his time that he'd set for himself for Boston, like by 5 minutes or something. And you would have thought that his dog had just been hit by a car. And because he had to go back, and that's all he did. He went to work. He went out with his buddies. Some of them ran. He was coming to Boston, and now he dreaded going back and telling that. That's because he had one goal and he didn't meet it. But if he'd had three or four goals, you know, I didn't get my time that I wanted, but under these circumstances, I finished, and I finished in the upper half of, you know, qualifying runners. So there are different things that you can do, even keeping in mind of mental mental goals that you have, that you don't feel like that you have stumbled mentally, if you will. That's a good goal to have. I felt good all the way through. When I crossed the finish line, I was feeling confident, just like I was at mile 19.
Yeah.
I really like the concept of association that you talk about and dissociation. Kind of explain to people what tricks you can use to help,
sure,
you know, get through a tough run particularly.
Well, association is where we identify our bodies with some external something. It can be an internal something as well, but we try to identify something that keeps moving. Or I don't know that you can hear it, but it's ironic that in the background, I can hear a train where I'm located right now. And that's always a good example of associating. You associate your body with a train that you're moving, that you are chugging forward,
engine that could.
Exactly. I think I can.
Yeah.
But it's that association. I had another guy that talked about that he associated himself with a Native American running through the woods. And he said, I'm barefooted, I have a loincloth on, and all I'm doing is just running and I'm free. And it just is something that I feel myself doing. So there are different ways of people doing that. Dissociation, yeah.
So I'm raising my hand, those that can't see. I got a question, Dr. Jeff.
Yeah. I don't know where you buy a loincloth. I really don't.
Yeah.
So,
man,
if that was your question, yeah.
Google it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Along with that association, would that include kind of imagining that you're in a movie? Because I think you mentioned that in the book, like you're in a running movie and cameras, yeah, are on you and you're flying down the trail. Because that's something that I've done before. Just imagine, like, okay, if there was a running documentary about me going from a couch potato to runner or whatever, and this is the apex of the movie is me running down this trail. This is what,
yeah,
it looks like right now.
The question is whether you're wearing a loincloth or not.
In your version, I'll wear one. But and the music is playing, you know, and I can imagine the camera angles. Would that be another example of association?
Yes. It also could be visualization, because you're visualizing that happening. Some people, they think their body is doing something, but it's not really doing that. So that's even where it's important to videotape yourself running, have someone get that on their camera and see what you're doing. If you're watching yourself like on a screen, or if you're watching yourself on a stage, any type of visualization like that, that is something that can be helpful as far as the visualization, but it also can be helpful just in correcting form and stride and a lot of different things that you may not be aware of. So that's one of those kind of crossover techniques. You can use it for visualization. You can also use it as association and having a variety of those things to bear down on when you need to is a great thing to do.
Okay, so association is imagining your body moving through space, as it were. And I'm guessing that disassociation has to do with thinking outside of yourself about some other object.
Exactly. And I always say there's a caveat here that we often use dissociation because of pain. And we have to really be in tune with our bodies. Research is very clear that seasoned runners are less apt to be injured than newbies, because they know what their body's telling them. And so many people will push through. And I've talked to people who've run with, goodness, all kinds of stuff. Like, oh, I had a toenail removed yesterday, and I'm a hairline. Or my doctor told me my femur has a hairline fracture in it, but I said I'm going to run anyway.
Oh, no.
So many different things. And I understand, because what we're not hearing those people say is why they're running. It may be in memory of someone, in honor of someone, those sorts of things that we can talk about too. But I think that the visualization piece is so important, and the association piece kind of comes along with that, that you let some other image kind of take over your body to give it some energy. And you might even associate with a runner next to you, that you start getting in stride with the runner who is not struggling, if you are. Or maybe neither of you are struggling. You're both in a group and you're just moving along. You almost feel like one person. But that dissociation, you have to pay attention to the pain and make sure that the pain is something that you are listening to, that you're not dissociating from that. When I speak to crowds, and we can do this, and the people listening can do this too. If you just reach down and you just pinch your arm real quickly, and you can do this. You can do this. Just pinch your own arm and pinch that till it hurts to, on a scale of 1 to 10 to about an 8, and then stop. Once you get to that 8, I want you to listen to my voice, and I'm going to tell you about a circus that has 8 clowns that come out, and they all are different colors, and you can see the different colors of the clowns as they come out and jump in the tent. Some of them have hair, some of them don't. One has a mohawk, and you can guess what color that mohawk probably is. And then you can hear the elephants in the background because they're getting ready to come out next, and they're going to run these guys all over the place. Okay, now, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is the pain on your arm now? It's probably no longer an 8.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It works. All right, wait, folks, rewind the tape and do that again if you weren't pinching yourself during that exercise, because that was cool.
Keep pinching the whole time.
Yeah, you pinch the whole time.
You got to pinch. So a couple things are probably happening. One, you're dissociating because you're putting your mind on something and you're visualizing. So see, this is one of those crossover sort of techniques that the visualization is good for goal setting and developing your skills and abilities, but it's also something that helps with dissociation because you had pain there, but you put your thinking onto something else and it pulled away from the pain. Now, it may not go away, but it may make it more tolerable. But I always say, if it's a certain kind of pain, like chest pain,
sure,
arm pain, don't do it if it's something that's an indication of something that's really significant that you need to be listening to your body, because your body is communicating to you through that pain. So that's a great way of doing that. I work a lot in the tent using dissociation once runners have made it there, because let's say they have muscle spasms and they come in and legs are pulled up to their chest because of just muscle contractions, and so physical therapy is in there, and they're trying to get their legs to just straighten out, and it's a very painful activity. So I'm there to help them with dissociation and tell them, I usually try to get them just to simply talk about something else. People like to talk about their kids. They like to talk about, sometimes you have to figure these things out, what it is that really are going to help them dissociate. I had a runner in Chicago one time who was just yelling at the top of his lungs that he was having so much pain. And I said, I'm Dr. Brown, a psychologist. I can help you dial down that pain if you want me to. I can try. And he said, you can try, doc, but it's not going to help. And I said, well, tell me, who did you travel with here today? And he said, nobody. It was too expensive. I had to come by myself. And I said, well, do you have like a job at home? What do you do for work? He said, I just lost my job.
Oh, no.
And I said, are you married? No, I'm not married. And then all the time, in between my questions, he's like yelling at the top of his lungs because of the pain. And I'm feeling really incompetent.
You're striking
right now
out with all these questions.
Striking out. And I said, so do you have a roommate? He said, no, I don't. I said, what a pet? Do you have a pet? He said, yeah. He said, my dog, but he was just hit by a car 2 weeks ago. And I was striking out everywhere, guys. And I'm thinking, oh, wait. Do you have a girlfriend? And he said, yes, I do. And I said, well, what's her name? And he told me her name. And I said, how long have you guys dated? Oh, he's yelling. And he says, we've dated 11 years. And I said, what do you tell her when she asks you about your fears of commitment? And I nailed it.
Wow.
It was like I had to get something that was significant enough to override that pain. But believe me, it was a shot in the dark.
Wow.
He said, I have no trouble with fears of commitment. And we've had multiple discussions about this. And all of a sudden, they were stretching his legs out. And he was telling me why commitment was not an issue for him. And it's like, okay, finally, My reticular activating system was already filling up with, you're an incompetent psychologist. Can't find this in this person. So another good, a fun example of dissociation.
That's awesome.
Wow, that's cool. What are the best things to tell ourselves or to think about when we're trying to dissociate?
Yeah, really, it can be a variety of things. Whatever it is, it needs to be rich in your senses and sensory-wise. Otherwise, it's probably not going to override or reduce some of that pain.
So anything? Imagine colors, imagine sounds, smells, they're saying.
Yeah, but in a particular thing, it's very common to think about going someplace where they feel relaxed and And but there are other things you can imagine too that are appealing to you, and you can just think about those things. And I've heard it all from runners who thinking about my kid hitting a home run. I was thinking about my honeymoon. I was thinking about, you know, anything that helps override that and serves as a good distraction.
And I suppose when people maybe listen to music or, you know, audiobooks on their run, that's a way of dissociating as well, because you can kind of get involved in this greater story.
It is. It is. As long as you I always tell people, and I've seen it, unfortunately, where people do get hit because they're not hearing with the earbuds and listening to music. I'm the same way. I would like to listen to something because it's a great time to kind of double train. You learn and you're running and you're getting in your time. So, you know, we also have to fight boredom at times. That's part of the deal, especially on the long runs. So having a playlist for that, variety of different things that you can do, but plan to do that.
Sometimes I'll have a certain song that just gets stuck in my head, and you know, I never listen to music while I run, but that will just, the lyrics will just repeat and repeat and repeat. And in a way, it's a way of dissociating, but also, you know, if it has positive lyrics, which is usually what I try to settle on, it also helps, you know, you keep that positive mental space going.
Yes, so. That's right. That's right. And almost you can get it, the beat of that lyric, even into your hitting the pavement or ground or whatever. It just is like becomes a mantra type, almost like a verbal engine running inside.
Exactly. And during races too, sometimes I feel like I have to dissociate from certain people. Like if a person runs really heavy, like their feet hit the ground really hard, or they breathe really heavy, or, you know, there's certain that just kind of like puts me in a negative space. I think I have to get around this person because their running form or their running space just seems like there's too much effort going on there.
Or maybe they're complaining.
Yeah. You know, people who will really verbalize their negativity during a race, you know, it's just like, okay.
And I think that's important before the race too, because even when you're in the corral or you're somewhere hanging out, you're trying to have some quiet time before, or you're listening to whatever your pre-race routine is, which is important. Those are some of the things that you don't. I think it's wise what you're saying, and is a good thing. And that is, I have to dissociate from some other runners around me because they're, maybe this is a t-shirt we need to do. Leave my RAS alone.
Exactly.
You know,
could stimulate some good conversations during the race as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so Jeff, probably the most interesting guest psychologically that we've had on the show is a guy named Marshall Ulrich, who had all his toenails removed because he was sick of having black toenails. He's an ultra marathoner. He ran across the USA. He holds the master's record, I think, for doing that, and wrote a book about it. So in the midst of doing this, he was doing like 40, 50 miles a day. He had a foot that was having issues. I mean, just intense pain. But he had to keep going. So the way that he dealt with it, he's told his foot that we're going across America, and, you know, if you want to cooperate with the rest of the body, then I'll be willing to welcome you back. But until then, I'm not going to talk to you or think about you because you're not fitting into my plan and what the rest of the body wants to do.
He disowned his foot.
Yeah. He disowned his foot. As a psychologist, hearing that story, and what kind of mental tactic was that? And what I would just love to hear your comment on that story.
Yeah, I like that because a couple of things it could have been for him. He probably just created that. A lot of runners just have skills that they don't know that they're even using. A lot of athletes are that way. But I'd say he was compartmentalizing his foot. And by doing that, he was able to dissociate from it too. It gave it a frame. So it's not like the foot, it's kind of isolated, kind of like when you run a virus scan. Basically, it's keeping that foot from affecting anything else in the body. So in that way, it's compartmentalization. It gives him a frame for thinking about it. That it's almost like what you'd say to your child of eight kids, the one that's misbehaving. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, we're going to go to the amusement park today, and you've been sassy for the last 3 days, and you're going to have to behave and go with us. And if you don't, you're not, one, you're not going to have as good a time, and two, you know, it's just the same frame. It's,
right.
It's the sassy kid that is the sassy foot. You know, I'm needing attention. I want your attention. Well, We're all working as a team over here. You're welcome to join the team. That's how you're going to get the best attention. I'll even buy you new socks if you behave. So I like that. I always have to add, though, you know, depending on what was really going on with this foot, this is somebody who had his toenails removed, which is kind of an already, I would guess, I don't diagnose people or make evaluations like that, but he's already willing to do extreme sorts of things and manage pain. And so I think it's neat. I'd love to talk to him about it, just see what he actually is doing about that. But that's a neat thing.
Yeah, he's a hardcore dude. Marshall Ulrich. Okay, so a final question I have before we get to the questions sent in from Academy members. There's so much more in the book, folks, that we haven't had time to talk about, so just get the book. But in the book, you talk about hitting the wall. So my question is, what exactly is happening mentally when someone hits the wall in a marathon?
Yeah, I think even hitting the wall for people, it's just when it can be a variety of things that have happened. I think psychologically, as we talked about, and that is the idea that someone expects to hit the wall. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that I'm going to hit the wall. It's kind of interesting when you talk to runners who don't really pay attention to where they are on the course. And so they didn't know that they've already passed the point where they should have hit the wall. That's really interesting. I talked to a lady who was a physician, and her husband was supposed to be running, I believe it was the LA Marathon. And his running buddy had to drop out at the last minute. She hadn't trained much. They were about 3 weeks out from the marathon. And he said, well, why don't you go with me? Everything's paid for. And just run as far as you can and then grab the bus and go on to the finish and we'll meet up. Well, she did that. And she ran with this other guy and kind of the pace that he was at. And they would talk and they were looking for the bus and got to mile 14 and you know, she was, you know, I'm ready for the bus. You know, she's down like in South Central LA and it's not many buses that say runners come here type thing. And so anyway, she kept looking for the bus and the water station would say, I think there's a bus maybe at the next mile. So she finally got to mile 23 looking for a bus running with this guy. Wow. And I think it was right at mile 23 where there was a bus. And this guy said to her, he said, you've run 23 miles, finish the marathon.
Exactly. You know?
And then you can't make this stuff up. So she went ahead and she finished. And when she crossed the finish line, the photo people were there. And she tripped and fell over the finish line after all.
No.
And she said she's got a picture of herself tripping and falling over the finish line. But it's interesting. She was preoccupied with finding the bus and just kept running. So for her, her mental expectation was to go 14, 15 miles and that'd be it. So physiologically, what's going on in our brain, I'd like to know really more about that. I know there are lots of good theories about that. Sometimes people say the brain will stop before your body. Well, that makes sense to a degree that I've seen some runners who are so depleted that it is affecting them cognitively. Their brain hasn't really stopped. Their brain just is misfiring. Just this last year, I had a runner at the finish line. She was probably 60. Cute little short lady that came in and she was just running and chugging right along and ran right at me and hit me.
Oh my.
And just kept running right into my chest. And, just didn't stop. And it's like, I said, you're here. You made it. She just kept running, you know, and her brain was working. It just wasn't working optimally because something, and I'm always reluctant. It's like, oh yeah, well, it was this part of the brain and it was this type of thing that actually happened that caused her to do that. To me, that is evidence of the amazing nature of our brains, that our brains can do so much that we don't even really understand what it can do. And it's so different from everybody. I always remind runners that I talk about Boston a lot because that's where I do most of my work. But let's say we have a field of 35,000 runners. Well, there are 35,000 different ways to get from the start to the finish, and no two are alike. And that's wild if you start thinking about that. And our brains are far more complex than that. So it's just it's an interesting thing, and it's a wonderful thing that we have, that regardless of what people believe and how you believe you got your brain, if it's evolved or was created, it is a powerful thing. And I see that our brains actually do have the ability to evolve. I just still haven't wrapped my head around starting with like pond scum. I just can't do that yet. But you know, getting the idea that our brains, because of neuroplasticity, it can change. So why do you have to hit the wall? And that may be with an entire book within itself at some point when we know more about the brain. Anyway, there's just so much that I don't get into in the book, but is necessary, that you're eating well, that you're sleeping well. Those things I do touch on, but it's not as exhaustive as some of the strategies and the mental toughness stuff. But making sure that you do take care of your brain, that you're giving it good stuff. You know, particularly runners need to do that, because your brain, you know, I said a lot that it's the 3 pounds that you never want to lose. Right. You know, I talk about, you hear about the diets and this and that. 3 pounds you never want to lose. And it's usually the 3 pounds that you want to make sure that crosses the finish line, and usually crosses first. So the brain, and I'm stating the obvious, but it's such a complex, amazing thing that has been given to us. And we're the only ones that can improve it. There's not going to be a brain 4.0 or 4.1 coming out. You already own your brain. The overhead's low. It's paid for. And it's yours to keep forever, and nothing will ever beat it. What will beat it is that you don't take care of it.
All right, we're going to go ahead and end the interview there. We talked with Dr. Brown for a good while longer, and he answered questions that were sent in from the community, but we've decided to make that part two because this episode's going to be pretty long otherwise. So I'll be looking forward to part two. Angie, a lot of stuff that he was talking about, you seem to do it really well. Like, I think you exemplify a lot of this stuff. I've seen you now run a lot of races. I've seen the look in your eyes at mile 20, 21.
It's a crazed look.
And she does keep smiling the whole time. Like, it doesn't matter how much pain you're in. I don't know if there's a race tough enough yet to wipe the smile off Angie's face. We'll have to find that race.
Believe me, in Leadville, I wasn't smiling as much. I was just trying to breathe.
So how do you disassociate? Like, what are some of the things that you find yourself always thinking about when it's particularly getting painful at the marathon?
I often think about other people who are experiencing big challenges in their life and not letting it stop them. And I think about how grateful I am for my strong body, even though maybe it's hurting at the moment. I think about, you know, it's my choice that I'm out here. And this is really something that I feel very privileged to do. It's not torture, you know, even though in that moment it may feel very uncomfortable and you may think, why did I ever sign up for this? And I've had those moments during marathons where I thought, I am never doing this again. And I would just give myself permission, okay, just finish the race and you never have to do another marathon. And then, of course, I'd cross the finish line and I'd be planning my next race, you know. So, you know, I think the mind is kind of funny how that works, but I often we'll focus outside of myself and try to focus on, you know, the beauty of the scenery, if that's something that's there, or people along the course, other runners. You know, there's a lot of interesting things to see if you have your eyes open or your ears open, even. Some of the conversations you hear during races is pretty interesting. And, you know, and sometimes I do think inward, and I will pray for people, or, you know, try to solve a problem in my head, something that's going on in my life or whatever. So, you know, like you said, there's a lot of different things that you can do, a lot of different methods of either association or dissociation.
I got this marathon coming up next weekend, and it's kind of a tough race because it's in September and it's in Mississippi and it's hot, but I haven't run a marathon in almost a year, so I'm a little bit nervous about it, but I've got a lot of resources to fall back on, you know, stuff that we've talked about even on this episode. But one of my strategies is going to be to have a really good running playlist of songs I like that will take me from beginning to end. So, you know, 4 or so hours of music.
5 or so hours.
Hey, watch it. Hopefully not. And especially in the later part of the marathon, I'm really going to try to pay attention to, like, just the musicality of the songs. I do like music. I play the guitar myself. So sometimes I'll just listen in and try to pick apart the song. You know, I like rock and heavy metal sometimes when I run, and I'll listen to like the lead part and I'll try to pick out the bass. Then I'll think about the drum work. And, you know, songs are very, you know, beautifully complicated, especially the music I like, Andy, that it's it's a work of art.
The kind of music he listens to makes me flee the room immediately. Not a big heavy metal fan.
So I find that that's a good distraction, trying to pick apart a song like that and really listen in. And it's amazing how you can hear like a certain part of a song that you haven't heard before, even though you've heard the song like 10 times. You can like pick out a certain part of it.
My eyes are rolling back in my head.
You can't identify with any of this at all?
No. I don't listen to music while running. I'm not a big music person, so
I don't know what planet you're from.
No, I can't.
So that's what I'm going to do. We'll see if it works. Angie and I do different things. Like,
yeah, and that's okay. It's good to point out that what works for one person may not work for you. And you can kind of find those strategies. And sometimes what you've used in the past won't work for a certain moment. And you can dig deep and find other strategies. It's all about, you know, changing and not being stagnant.
All right. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And a really great question came up in our group about how long should your longest training run be? I don't know if we've talked about this in detail before, but in our group, a runner named Mark from North Carolina asked a really great question that I thought would be helpful here on the podcast. He says he'll be running Chicago coming up, and he's following one of our training plans, and our training plans call for the longest training run is 20 miles. And he says, is that, you know, basically, is that enough? If a marathon's 26, is it really enough to just do 20 in training? You know, why not 22, 23, or maybe even some people have asked, why not the full 26 just to know that you can make it? So, Angie, what would you say about that?
Yes, this is a great question, and it's one that we get pretty frequently, and I'm sure maybe people out in the audience have wondered this before. Is 20 miles enough to run in training before a marathon? And what I found from my experience and research is that for the majority of runners, especially newer runners, newer marathoners, that 20 miles is going to get you physically and mentally prepared to run the full marathon. And going beyond that 20-mile training run just increases the risk of injury, and it just takes longer to recover from. As a newer marathoner, you definitely don't want to be delving into the area of overtraining or to get some kind of injury going into it. For some very experienced runners, through the years they may have found that it's beneficial for them to maybe do 22, 24 miles. But again, that's something you have to really listen to your body, and is not advisable for someone maybe who's doing their first few marathons. I've never done more than 20 miles in training for any of my marathons. And if you can do a solid 20 miler or a couple of them in your training, really, you just have to start working also on your mental game, because sometimes that's where it comes down to, is not feeling mentally ready to run 6.2 more miles. It can seem like that distance is so much further, but once you get to 20 miles in the marathon, you really just have to think about how many other times that you've run 10K in training. And yes, it may be uncomfortable. You may feel unprepared, and in some respects you may feel a little bit scared because this is kind of going beyond what you've ever done before. But I think that's part of the beauty of the marathon, is doing something like that for the first time and pushing your body. So I guess the bottom line is to trust your training plan, and some will call for anywhere from 16 miles as your longest training run. Some may go up to 24 miles.
No way, 16?
Yes.
I would be nervous about that one.
Yeah, there's, you know, some well-known plans that call for 16 milers as your longest run.
Wow.
You know, you just really have to listen to your body and realize that sometimes doing more does not give you better results. And I found that just the risk of injury increases, and you know, if even if you did like maybe a 24 mile run in training, it may not make you feel more ready for the marathon. It may actually decrease your confidence. So do those 20 milers and just really work on your mental game, like this podcast was about giving yourself positive affirmations that you are ready and that you can do this, and you know, just be confident going into it even though you're nervous.
Well, I hope that's helpful for you who've ever wondered about that question when it comes to your training plan, whether it's one from MTA or somewhere else. always remember that the information on this podcast is not meant to take the place of the advice of your doctor. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. We're so honored to be on this running journey with you. You can find a lot more over on our website. You can also find out how to join the Academy and go through our courses. And you can join our mailing list and get a free audio gift where I tell the story of training and running my first marathon. It's one of our most downloaded episodes of years gone by. You can find that over at marathontrainingacademy.com. Big thanks again to Jeff Brown. Be looking forward to part two, which should be coming at you soon, where we're going to dive more into the runner's brain. And of course, we'd like to end every show by reminding you, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way.